From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call us now at 800-462-7413. Of course, along with your calls, some topics to talk over, Zorba, what are they?
Yes, we're going to talk about exercise. 1 minute. Is that as good for you as going to exercise in the gym 45 minutes a day, 3 days a week?
I hope so, because I do that gym thing.
Exactly.
I'd like to get out of it.
Exactly. Let's try to make our exercise. But we'll talk about some interesting data about it.
Yeah.
And the FDA has had requirements for physicians, sort of voluntary requirements that physicians learn about painkillers to essentially prescribe them the right way. There's a change in how we should prescribe them. They're beginning to rethink them to see whether or not they're really accomplishing what they want to accomplish.
Okay, and our recipe.
Salmon and veggie fajitas. Delicious.
Sounds
delicious.
Good to me.
Do you like fajitas?
I do.
Yeah.
And
this
I like
is a good
salmon.
Recipe. And you like veggies.
And I like veggies. Right, that's
ready,
right.
Ready. Yeah, if we had a tofu fajita. You know, we haven't had a tofu recipe in a long time, have we? You know?
That's because I've been twisting
That's right. That's right.
Let's not
that's
have
it.
Any tofu.
That's it. We need an all tofu recipe. That's what we need. Tofu and tofu. That's it. So.
Let's get to the phones. 800-462-7413 is our number. And Zorba, our first caller, is a listener in Marco Island, Florida. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I have a question that's been kind of burning within our family unit. My husband's mother always reminds us that we need to eat beans 3 times a day, and any type of beans, from green beans to yellow beans to black-eyed peas, anything in the legume family.
Mm-hmm.
And they will, if we are having trouble sleeping at night, she says, get up and eat a tablespoon of beans, and you'll be able to go right back to bed.
Yeah.
And even our sister-in-law's Crohn's disease, she swears it will cure it, but, of course, the sister-in-law's doctor says no, it might kill her. So I'm just trying to ask your opinion
okay,
on
well,
the bean you said, dilemma.
You say your husband's mother has this idea?
Well, it's not yes. It's her nutritionist up, or up, you know, in her hometown area. So
yeah. Well, your husband's mother is right.
Beans.
Is right. She is.
Well, wait a second. Wait a second. Wait a second.
Mother
Tom.
Is always right.
Wait a second. That's exactly. So beans.
For breakfast is the new.
So eating beans. Her nutritionist said, eat beans three times a day.
Well, we've been there, and we've had refried beans for breakfast.
Refried.
And we are, yep, and we're not allowed to have any fruits with sugar in them, like bananas or strawberries or vegetables that have sugar, because that has been cut out of the diet as well.
That has been cut out of the diet. And if you're having trouble sleeping in the middle of the night, get up and have a teaspoon of, like, baked beans.
any beans. So, you know, she says anything in the legume family, like chickpeas or, baked beans if they're in your fridge, or green beans.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you just eat those and you'll be able to fall right back to sleep.
Uh-huh. You know, I have to tell you, I am always blown away by diets in America. And I hear a lot of variations, you know, the paleo diet, the grapefruit diet that used to be very popular to lose weight. But I have never heard of the all-bean diet. And this is a variation. Now, I've always been interested in writing a book about gas, because we have lots of people who are interested in gas because they don't like to, I'm going to use the F word, fart, which is, by the way, an acceptable word.
Why don't you say it a few more times?
I've said it enough. I know that it's acceptable. It's not one of the four-letter words that's dinged by the powers to be. But if you have the all-bean diet, you're going to tend to pass gas a little bit more often than not. And I just think it's very interesting, nutritionist. So your mother-in-law, is she overweight, normal weight, healthy? A little bit about her.
No, I would say she's probably normal weight, I suppose.
And how long has she been on the all-gas? How long has she been on the all-gas diet?
She's been eating beans for at least 4 years, four or 5 years.
Uh-huh. And is she married? She's still married?
Yes. Yep. She's 75.
Her husband eats beans all the time?
He eats what is put in front of him. Yep.
He eats what is put in front of him. I love it. I love it. So the real issue, if I may give you some advice, mm-hmm. the real issue is how do you gently handle your mother-in-law's there's a Yiddish word, verkackte diet. Verkackte means, it's another word for sort of loony. Now, and I mean it, but it's a respectful looniness. It's not
okay.
It's not a bad looniness. How do you handle it? And I think you say something like, Mom, if you call her Mom, or what do you call your mother-in-law, by the way? Do you call her Mom? Or?
I just call her Carol or Mom. Yeah. Mostly Carol,
You know, I would say, Carol, you know, individualizing your diet is important, and I think beans are important for you, and I'm going to have beans on a regular basis, but not quite as often, because I spoke to Dr. Zorba Pastor and Tom, and they said the diet was one of those unusual diets that can be that can be used for some people who like to eat beans. Mm-hmm. And then I would ask her if she has a gas problem.
But I think she's been eating them so long now her body has really adjusted.
Has really adjusted. Or she and her husband have adjusted to gas in the house, one of the other thing.
Or, yes. But there is no real health benefit from eating beans 3 times a day, 7 days a week.
Not at all. Legumes are great. Okay. Legumes are important. Legumes have lots of good nutritional value to them, the fiber in them, everything else. But eating beans 3 times a day, I don't think it has much value, although it may be a topic for a good diet book that might be on Dr. Oz's best-selling list if we can give it to him. Yeah. So.
Well, that's another show I stay away from. So.
Well, thanks so much for your call. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I will share my my newfound wisdom. So.
There it is. There it is.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, this Zorba brings me back to my childhood. Do you know the jingle associated with beans? Beans, the musical fruit. The more you eat, more you toot. The more you toot, the better you feel. So beans with every meal.
You know what, Tom? We have to set that. I have an idea that that we might be able to set that to music.
Well, we have Brad, the musician.
That's right. That's right. And we have Carl, and I have an idea that one day we might actually play that jingle on the air. I bet they'll do it.
Now, can you do harmony?
Of course.
Oh, okay.
Please, come on. I'm a doctor. Doctors know how to do harmony. We're known for our singing. You know, if we can't cure people, we sing to them. That's what
well, I've
we
been
do.
Seeing my doctor for a lot of years. He's never sung to me. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, tell us about the one-minute all-out exercise.
Well, it's kind of, and we'll talk a little bit about it as an interesting workout. I do, for my own exercise program at home, I have an elliptical, which I like doing a lot. It's really easy, good on my joints. And then I'll often do some other exercise with these straps that I have. And then I do a 7-minute exercise program, which I think is quite good. There are a number of them. There are apps. You know, I talk to the guy as he's actually doing it. He doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I talk to him. But, and the question has been, are these short workouts worthwhile? And this is another example of it. And it's a 1-minute workout. And it's a very interesting study that shows some of the benefits of what you might call interval training. So here's the research. 25 out-of-shape young guys. Okay, mm-hmm. They were all men. They didn't test women. 25 out-of-shape young college guys. Okay, mm-hmm. Couch potato college guys don't do anything. So you have to remember, these are, can you picture them?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah, you can picture
them. I used to be one of them.
Yeah, that's right. You were the typical couch potato guy. I'm trying to picture you back at 18 or 19 or 20. We don't have any pictures of you when you're that young. Do you have any photos at home?
I look the same.
Yeah, right. It's exactly right. So they took 3 groups of people. Group number 1, they didn't do anything. Okay,
right.
They were the control group. Hi, guys. See you later. Come back in a few months. Group number 2 were actually, these were volunteers, and they were, they 2 minutes on a stationary bike, pedaled as hard as they could for 20 seconds, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then rode at another slow pace for 2 minutes, okay? Sprinted all out hard as they could for 20 seconds. Recovered with slow running for 2 minutes, and then 20 20 minutes of hard riding, okay, fast as they could. So they only have 60 seconds, 1 minute of hard riding with soft pedaling in between and a cool down for 3 minutes, okay? 3 minute start, 3 minute there, this, you know, these 20 minute intervals. The entire workout only lasted for about 10 minutes, okay?
All right.
The other group did usual type of training. They did an endurance training. They rode at a moderate pace on a stationary bike for 45 minutes, okay? So you got the couch potatoes, 45 minutes on the bike, and then you've got 20 seconds of really hard interval training, okay? At the end of the study, they measured them at 12 weeks, 3 months later, end of the study. What happened to the couch potatoes? Anything?
Well, they probably didn't get any health benefits.
So they were just couch potatoes, same thing. But then they compared these sprinters with the people who were exercising at a moderate pace for 45 minutes. They both had improved significantly in the fitness, in the way they measured their muscle mass and their aerobic fitness. There was no difference between 45 minutes of pedaling three times a week at a moderate pace versus this 20-second all-out endurance for these three different intervals. There was no difference at all. The upshot is after 3 minutes, they were exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, that isn't 1 minute. They did something.
It basically was a 10-minute workout. No, it was 20 seconds. 20 seconds on, you know, a minute, you know, 30 seconds rest. 20 seconds on, 30 seconds left. 20 seconds on, 30 seconds.
It was
a very quick workout. And there was no difference in how they could measure them. Now, this is kind of an interesting concept. The question then is, do you get more or as much from this interval training the way you can measure it versus not? Remember, A, it's in college students, okay? They're not the same as other humans.
Right?
They're college students. They're young. They're not the same as you would be in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Mm-hmm. But I think it really shows something else. Interval training, where you're pushing it all out for a short period of time, might be very beneficial for your heart. And that's really where it shows. And these short, really tough intervals may actually be producing much more aerobic training than we ever thought. And it might be, according to this, just as good as simply just going at a moderate pace for a long period of time. So I find it kind of fascinating. And I like this 7-minute workout that I do on the phone. 7 minutes is longer, but I like it because it gets my heart rate up and it's interesting. And to me, if it's interesting, I'm more likely to do it.
Oh, yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah. I had a patient the other day, came into the office, and I said, do you exercise? And I said, yeah. I said, what do you find the hardest thing you do? He said, walking through the door.
Yeah, I get that. 800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Combined Lux, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure, how can we help?
Well, I have a question. When I was younger in elementary school, I had epilepsy. And, you know, as I grew out of it, using that with quotation marks around it, and I was off medication for, you know, probably 30 years. And in 2011, I started having seizures again. And worse than they were, I had the mild petit mal seizures when I was in grade school. And I started having grand mal seizures in 2011. So I started going to the doctor, and they did the full gamut MRIs and tests and EEGs and trying to find out the cause. And as it was when I was a child, when I was a kid, they could not find a cause. So their approach was to put me on medication and continue to change medications and increase the medications until the seizures generally went away, the grand mal. And I still have mild seizures where I don't lose consciousness. So they continue to slowly increase the medication. But I'm wondering if there's another approach, because the side effects of the medication are fatigue. And I mean, it's just not something that I desire to continue to do. So I'm wondering if there's other approaches, because that's really the approach that I've been to three different doctors, and it's just the medication.
So when you were younger and you had petit mal seizures, were you discriminated against in school at all?
You know, I wasn't, because I was from a small town, and actually the kids were very supportive.
Good.
You know, it was a very small group. It was maybe 11. I think there were 12 to 13 of us in the class, and I was with the same kids for my entire elementary school. So
it was a very small town. And the reason I ask that is, years ago there used to be a lot of discrimination against epileptics, and they were also thought of as being dumb. because basically they had trouble learning because they were having seizures. And it took a while to get rid of that discrimination. In modern times, people don't discriminate the same way. I mean, it's not the, you know, they're not the same issues. So you had idiopathic seizures, you know, meaning we don't, you know the reason that they occurred. And then they disappeared for 30 years, which was, you know, obviously wonderful when they were gone. And then they did MRIs and other scans to see whether or not there was something they could find, you know, a purpose for it. Was there a scar tissue? Nothing showed up on that?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bit shocked because I sold industrial chemicals for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I have a tumor.
Right.
I was shocked when there was nothing.
Nothing there. I mean, idiopathic means that, you know, that we don't know why they occurred. And frankly, we don't know why they didn't occur continuously. Part of the issue is why did you have this 30 years where you had no seizures? Because many, many epileptics, I'm sure the vast majority have seizures and they go off their medications. Some people go off their medications, they don't have seizures anymore, but a lot of people go off their medications and they immediately have seizures again. So you had that good fortune. There really is not a diet that helps with something such as this. The issue is there are certain things that may trigger seizures. There are things such as blinking lights, flashing lights that can trigger them. There are a number of things, food, lack of food, dehydrations. There are certain things that can trigger them. But there's nothing that can assure you that you won't have them. You have to keep on taking your medications. That's the answer. Now, that's the short answer. The long answer is, what is the minimal amount of medication and what's the medication that will have the fewest side effects? Those are really the issues. And there are a variety of different anti-seizure medications. They're all individual. They all work differently. And it's a matter of working with your neurologist to try to find the right combination that will be the best for you. The other issues are exercise and sleep. How much sleep do you get a night?
Well, and that's one of the things I changed when it started. I'm getting minimum of 8 hours sleep a night. And I started exercising, oddly enough. You know, you had talked about the cycle training, type of training, and I started that in August of last year because with the medication, it was just kind of driving me down.
Right.
You know, I'm not who I was, getting out there and exercising really helps me keep that energy level up.
That is exactly the right thing to do. You want to follow a Mediterranean diet because a Mediterranean diet is the king of diets. It is the diet that works. There's no doubt about it. So you want to follow a Mediterranean diet. You want to exercise on a regular basis, and you want to make sure you get enough sleep. Those are the things. You want to make sure you have a neurologist who can help you regulate things. And then, frankly, you know, the other drug that you can use to help you stay awake is caffeine. And caffeine is a great drug. I mean, that's what it is, the most commonly used drug in the world, you know, has minimal side effects for most people. And taking the appropriate amount of coffee during the day may actually help, you know, keep you awake, and that's an okay thing to use. If you're sleepy from the medication, you might also consider, your physicians might consider drugs that we use for ADD. Such as methylphenidate, which is Ritalin, or other medications. Now, it's in other medications. You have to think about whether you want to do it. But sometimes small doses of that, when you need it, can be very, very useful because they're obviating the side effects of the seizure medications.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you very
thanks
much.
For your call.
Sure,
thanks for, thanks
your
for
call.
Sharing that. And I'm glad you had all of that support when you were younger. That's the wonderful thing about living in a small town.
Yeah. A line open for you at 800-462-7413, 1-800-462-7413. And before the break, Sorba, let's hear from your favorite backseat drivers, the Grammar Police. Today's correction comes to us from a listener, Chris, who lives across the pond in Great Britain. He writes, I enjoy your show and listen to it here in the UK via the magic of the internet. May I just correct you on one little point? It's not Celtic salt, as in Celtic. It's Celtic salt with the C as in colt. The same goes for Celts.
Oh.
What may confuse our American cousins is that there is a football team in Glasgow whose name is Celtic, said like S-E-L-T-I-C. Don't ask me. Thanks.
I love it. We've got a listener in the UK. Way to go. Way to go.
So are you going to take his advice?
100%. Okay. I don't have Celtic blood in me, but I certainly can say Celtic.
Very good. Hey, listeners, do you feel assaulted by something Zorba said? Join the ever-growing ranks of the Grammar Police by posting your thoughts to Facebook or sending them along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
A recipe is coming up. You'll enjoy it. More of your calls, of course. Another interesting topic to talk over. And a medical mythbuster right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number again, 800-462-7413. You'll find a line open now if you call us at 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, salmon and veggie fajitas.
That's right, salmon and veggie fajitas. You know, you pronounced that correctly.
Salmon?
Yeah, right. Salmon, that's exactly.
I was going to say salmon. Yeah.
Well, you know that, but that's what, when I speak to my friends from India, my Tibetan friend, they do pronounce the L. And in England, and in India, they pronounce the L. They call
I
it
didn't
salmon.
Know that.
They call it salmon. Why do we call it salmon? Why is the L silent?
I have no idea.
I wonder if anyone knows why the L is silent in salmon.
They'll contact us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
Let's do the recipe.
Or post it on Facebook. Yeah. Okay. All right, start out with 16 ounces of salmon fillet.
Mm-hmm. 16 ounces salmon fillet.
A red bell pepper sliced.
A red bell pepper sliced.
A green bell pepper sliced.
A green bell pepper sliced.
A yellow bell pepper sliced.
A yellow bell pepper
sliced.
Yeah,
and if you can't find those, all green are just fine, of course. But yeah. They all taste. The red are the sweetest. I love the red peppers. One onion halved and cut into slices.
An onion halved and cut into slices.
Third of a cup of olive oil. Extra virgin tasty.
Third of a cup of olive oil.
Now, I want to talk a bit about olive oil. There are different types of olive oil. And what I recommend, there are certain places I like to go. I like to go to Trader Joe's, but there are a lot of other markets, Metcalf's, other markets in Madison I like to go to. And the extra virgins taste different. I mean, some are much more robust, some are lighter. And find olive oils that you like. And I use different olive oils for different tastes. I have three or four olive oils in my house. So choose the olive oil you like, if you like the robust, which I do.
Yeah.
A tablespoonful of chili powder.
A big tea chili powder.
That used for making chili. 2 teaspoons of ground cumin.
2 little tea ground cumin.
1/2 teaspoon of garlic powder.
1/2 little tea garlic powder.
And folks, make sure your garlic powder is fresh. I think it tends to go. I used to buy large containers that lasted for longer periods of time, and I think garlic powder gets stale. I buy small containers now. 1 pinch of chili flakes.
Pinch of chili flakes.
Flakes, flakes, flakes. 1 teaspoon of salt.
1 little tea salt.
I hope you're taking this all down. You know, I know this is all in your head. You've got it all in your immediate memory, right?
Well, yes, of course.
Of course. Half teaspoon of ground pepper.
1/2 little tea ground pepper.
Okay, 12 corn tortillas.
12 corn tortillas.
Some cotija cheese.
Cotija cheese.
Yeah, you said that and you're sort of making a funny face. It's a Mexican cheese.
Okay.
You find it at a Mexican restaurant.
Right.
Ask at the desk. When you go to your Mexican restaurant and you make this, just go to the desk and say, where's the cotija cheese?
And you'll get it.
Next time you find yourself in a Mexican grocery, Hispanic grocery store, which will be never. And
I thought you were going to say restaurant.
Cilantro, and of course, cilantro is optional. If you're a cilantro hater, use parsley.
Okay, cilantro.
Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. Then line a large sheet, a cookie sheet with foil. Place the whole salmon fillet in the center of it. Then in a small bowl, combine the oil, chili powder, cumin, chili flakes, garlic, salt, and pepper. Whisk it until it's combined. Brush the fillet with a small amount of olive oil mixture. Then toss the remaining mixture with veggies and pour onto the sheet pan, spreading it around the salmon. Okay, mm-hmm. You've got this wonderful mixture around the salmon. Then bake it for 20 minutes until the salmon is cooked through and the veggies are soft, kind of crispy. And it's going to be about 20 minutes for that. And then serve it family style with the warm corn tortillas in the middle of the crumbled cojita cheese, cilantro on there, and just make your own fajitas. It's wonderful. It's
really, sounds really good.
It really is.
Now, there are 12 of these. Mm-hmm. Is that 12 different people, or can you eat two or three? And
You can eat all 12. That's all. Set the table for 12. That's what I recommend. And go from one seat to the other around the table while you're eating them. It's 12 different plates to do it. You do it any way you want to if you make this. Now,
yeah.
Tom, where can people find this recipe?
You're going to tell me.
I'm going to tell you. You threw it right back to me. Facebook, or at zorbapastor.org. Actually, that's where you find the recipe. Yeah. Pictures of Tom, pictures of me, archive recipes, fun stuff. We've got a wonderful Facebook, a wonderful website, zorbapastor.org. Find us on Facebook or when I occasionally tweet.
Back to the phones we go, Zorba, at 800-462-7413. And a Niagara Falls listener is with us now. Hi.
Hi. Good to talk to you guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
So I have type 2 diabetes, and I've been losing weight lately, and I'm trying to control my blood sugar with my diet. And for breakfast, I like to put a little bit of oatmeal with my cinnamon. And for lunch, I like to have a little bit of salad with my ranch dressing. And then I've also heard that you can have some fruit because the fiber in fruit is the antidote to the sugar of the fruit. And I want to know if any of this holds water because I'm trying not to reduce my salt.
The issue of blood sugar control, when we look at it, is the number of calories, the kind of calories, and the total volume of calories that you're eating in a sitting. So if you're sitting down and you're having half a dozen apples, I don't care if you eat the whole apple or anything else, it's just too much for your body. Tell me what you're doing for exercise.
For breakfast, I usually eat either a raisin bran with honey mm-hmm. and milk uh-huh. or oatmeal with a little bit of brown sugar and mm-hmm. a lot of cinnamon.
Uh-huh. Well, I think a little bit of brown sugar is okay. How much is a little? In Wisconsin, when I tell people, I ask them how much they drink, they say, I don't drink much. For some, not drinking much means a drink, and for others, it means a six-pack. So bringing that down to sugar, how much sugar do you use?
Well, typically I can only eat it if I have about a heaping tablespoon full.
Yeah, that's not that much sugar. I mean, that's 45 calories. That's not a lot of calories from a sugar point of view. Do you drink your calories? Do you have any sugar drinks?
I used to, but I've been cutting back on that. I stopped drinking sodas a long time ago. I'm stuck to water mostly now.
Yeah, I would not drink. If I were diabetic, I would get rid of all my juices. I mean, tomato juice would be fine, but I wouldn't have any fruit juices because fruit juices are loaded with sugar. I don't care. You know, you wouldn't drink your calories. Have a piece of fruit. The fiber slows down the digestion and thereby makes it less insulin resistant. But the other thing is exercise, moving around on a continuous basis throughout the day. In other words, if you're a couch potato and you don't move around, you're not going to move that blood sugar into yourselves. What do you do for a living?
I'm actually a taxi driver, so I'm sitting in a car all the time.
Right, you're sitting in the car, so you have to be aware of it. What do you do for exercise? What is your exercise routine?
Walking. A lot of times I'm walking around Niagara Falls mm-hmm. and seeing the sights. Maybe I'm showing people the sights, or maybe I'm walking to work because I only live a couple blocks away uh-huh. from where
okay.
I drive.
Okay. So exercise throughout the day counts. You know, doing some aerobic exercise 3 times a week is good, but exercising through the day is going to help. The whole goal is to reduce the insulin resistance of your cells. As a type 2 diabetic, your cells are resistant to insulin, and so your pancreas has to produce more and more insulin to get that effect. Exercise is the antidote to that. And exercise throughout the day means It's getting up and walking around. You know, so when you've got a break, you know, which you don't always have, but when you've got a break in your taxi cab, just getting out and walking around for a block and walking back is going to help get the blood sugar that you're digesting into your cells. So when you take your lunch, after your lunch, if it's possible, take a walk. Even 5 minutes will make a difference. Or do some jumpy jacks for 30 seconds or a minute. You'll get a little aerobic exercise. You can do it by the side of the cab. You might look a little goofy, but you'll do it, and that will help a lot.
Yeah, I've always told people that diabetes is basically gasoline trucks on the freeway that can't get off because there's not enough off-ramps to the cells or gas stations.
Oh, I like it. I like it. That is a really, really good analogy. That is a wonderful analogy. A gasoline truck, and there are just not enough off-ramps to get that off. That is a great analogy. It's visual. I can't you picture it right away, Tom?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I can immediately picture. So, yeah, keep up the good work. Sounds like you're doing the right stuff.
All righty. Thank you.
Sure. Appreciate the call. At 800-462-7413.
You know, we have a lot of truck drivers and taxi drivers that listen to us in the car, and they have special needs because they're often sedentary. It's a sedentary job. Yep. They're in their car, and they're in their truck, in their rig, and they have special needs that are important to address.
Yeah. And he was calling from Niagara Falls and said he walked along and watched the falls.
How wonderful. Have you been there to Niagara Falls?
Yeah, it's
I've
amazing.
Been there numerous times. It's amazing. Yeah. It blows you away.
Yeah, it does. 800-462-7413 is our number, and a Loganville, Wisconsin listener is with us now. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Okay, so I started listening to your show, and I was listening about the dementia news segment that you had, and I was wondering how soon should patients go off of statin medication for their cholesterol when they have dementia?
You know, I'll tell you something. I don't... the dementia question of statins is something I don't really believe is important, and I'll tell you why. There's been an amazing drop in dementia and Alzheimer's that has occurred, according to the Framingham study, over the last 30 years. So if you look at people from the 70s to the 80s, the 1980s to 1990s, the 2000s, 1990s to 2000, and the 2000 to 2010, and you take these groups of these 10-year groups, and you look at relative dementia, there's been a dramatic drop in dementia per capita in the Framingham study over the last 30 years. So a dramatic drop.
Why would that be?
Well, the drop in dementia parallels the increase in the use of statins and the increase in use of blood pressure pills. And half of all dementia is not Alzheimer's. Half of all dementia is due to what we think are small vessel disease, infarcts in the brain. Infarcts means actually, you know, little blood vessels that do that. And so this risk of dementia in statins, I think, is really overblown. And I am very, very pro-statin. It's a very special drug. And, you know, it's like it's just an important drug. And if you need to be on a statin, I think it's useful.
How about patients that have Alzheimer's? Should they be on statins?
If they have high blood pressure and high cholesterol, yes, I think so. I think so. My mom died of Alzheimer's. Now, she may not have died of Alzheimer's. She smoked a pack a day or two packs a day until she forgot that she was a smoker. One day she looked at the cigarettes and said to my dad, "What are these?" And he said, "Oh, you don't need them." And that was it. She was done, but she smoked a pack to two packs a day. Everyone, my father smoked cigars, everyone in the family, in my family, smoked. And so she may not have had an Alzheimer's disease, and statins weren't invented. The issue about Alzheimer's, if you have it, is that it is a progressive disease, and we do not know how to stop it. But a lot of Alzheimer's is mixed. It's Alzheimer's, and it's small vessel disease of dementia. And so I believe that statins are more useful. But let me go to a side for 1 second. Do you drive your car?
Yes,
you drive a car. Do you drive when it's raining outside?
Yeah.
Do you drive when it's snowing outside? Do you ever drive in snow?
Yes.
Yeah. How about an ice storm? Do you drive in an ice storm?
Oh, unfortunately, I've also driven in an ice storm.
Yeah, but you had to drive somewhere, right? You've driven, but it's not elective. You didn't go to the mall shopping in the middle of an ice storm. So you're taking a risk. And the risk is a relative risk. I think I look at the risk of dementia from statins as it's drizzling outside and partly cloudy. It's so minimal. It's not an ice storm. I look at the other side, the risk of what can happen if you need to be on a statin and you're not on it, more in the heavy snow and ice storm range. That's what I think of. So we balance our risks. We make our choices. And I think statins are a good choice.
Okay.
I hope that helps. Are you on a statin, by the way?
No, I'm not. I have an elderly grandparent who has Alzheimer's, and I was just worried about if the statin that she's on, if it's something that, you know, improving her condition or making it worse.
Yeah, so I would think it would improve the condition. But there is one other thing you have to think about with Alzheimer's. If it's end-of-life Alzheimer's, you know, where the person doesn't know where they are, like my mom, who was around, and they have a terrible quality of life. At that point, I think one has to make a decision of hospice and whether or not you want to continue to be on any medications at all, because what are we doing? And I think that then becomes the palliation part, and that's very hard. Those are tough decisions that have to be made on an individual basis, and that becomes a different issue. So, well, good luck. It's good that you're advocating for your relative.
Thank you. Okay. Well, thanks so much for taking my call.
No,
we appreciate that call. Thank you very much. And before the break, Zorba, we recently received this letter from a listener in Buffalo, New York. She writes, "Hello, Dr. Pastor. I hope that you could address the seriousness and complications of alcoholism. A friend of mine will not listen to me. He is a kind, generous, loving man. He's wonderful to me, his family, etc. He has a wonderful job and never misses work. He is 55 years old and considers himself a functioning alcoholic. I try to tell him an alcoholic is an alcoholic, but he almost makes it sound that because he is a functioning alcoholic, it's not that bad. He has been drinking from a young age. His dad used to drink, and he claims he drinks because it is who he is. On his days off, it's easy for him to drink 12 to 14 beers, but what bothers me more than a beer is a pint or two of 100-proof whiskey.
Oh, gosh.
I've suggested he get help, but that goes nowhere. I took care of my mom and dad in their old age, and I don't want to do that again. At least my mom and dad passed away from age-related issues, not addictions. He does not seem to get that. This is a disease, a progressive disease, that it only gets worse."
Oh, it only gets worse. He's right. I mean, she's right. It's a disease. It's a progressive disease. It only gets worse. He is a functioning alcoholic because he's going to work, because you have to work to make money to get your booze. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's common. That's usually the last thing to go is your job, because without your job, you don't have money, you don't have access to the alcohol, and an alcoholic knows that. And this guy is clearly an alcoholic, clearly should have help, and the issue, obviously, is they're not motivated, and that's always the big issue. You know, and quite often, alcoholics who have been alcoholics their whole life do not get motivated until something happens.
Yeah, they're saying, "I'm 55 years old, I'm doing fine."
Yeah, and you're not doing fine. What happens is you lose 10 to 15 years of life. If you drive your car, of course, you know, you have a risk of killing me or one of my kids or something else. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's only so much you can do. And it reminds me of one of my distant patients years ago, functioning alcoholic, that's what he said, ran a printing business, had a family, got drunk every night, but, you know, he never drove his car when he was drunk, lived with an apartment building. This was in Chicago. And when his mom died, he then, the next day, committed suicide. That was it. In other words, all of a sudden his mom died. He was an alcoholic, saw no reason to live for whatever reason it was connected to him. And he said, "Well, I'm out of here," you know, committed suicide with a gun. So alcoholics are at risk for a whole bunch of things, including suicide and other things. And the only thing you can do is encourage them or have them reach bottom or not deal with them. But she's right. She may have a tough situation on her hand.
Have a story to share? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research coming up. More of your calls, of course, on our Medical Myth Buster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark here with Dr. Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Zorba, before our next call, what's this about the FDA considering painkiller training requirements for you doctors?
Well, this has actually gone on for a couple of years. The FDA recognizing a couple of years ago that we were at the beginning of an epidemic, which we are, of painkillers, initially said, well, we are going to require doctors to actually go through training before they can prescribe painkillers. And the reality is that's not a good idea. I mean, I disagree with that because there'd be pushback. What would happen is you would stigmatize patients. Number of doctors would not do the training. You would reduce access to people who really need it. But the FDA put forth and said, okay, the pharmaceutical industry has got to pay for training, and we're going to encourage doctors to take the training. You're going to get CME, and it's something. And they trained a whole bunch of physicians with this. There was a huge push to do this. There were about almost 38,000 physicians actually did the training. They targeted, the FDA wanted to have about 80,000. They did the training. They would have a nice lunch. It would be free continuing medical education. We have to have a certain amount. Mm-hmm. And I actually have participated in one of them. I did a couple of training sessions with that. And I thought it was really quite good. But now the FDA is looking back and saying, has this done anything? That's the real question. Has it actually reduced the amount of narcotics that we prescribe? And I, being a physician at the time, so as part of that whole issue, was, you know, too willy-nilly to prescribe opioids, giving too many opioids for too long a period of time. And so the FDA is now questioning this and what we should do about it. And it's a really big issue.
I don't know. You may not agree with this, or maybe this is false. I heard on the news the other day that painkillers cause more deaths than any other drug.
Well, painkillers cause a lot of deaths. It may be that they do cause more deaths than any other drug, but on the other hand, it would be hard to compare it to others. But we do know that overuse of narcotics is causing lots of deaths and is really the gateway to heroin, which is ubiquitous, you know, in the country, and we have to start to push back on it. On the other hand, we have patients who need chronic pain meds, and the real issue is how much do they need, because Americans use lots of narcotics in other countries. In Western Europe, they don't use nearly as much.
How do I know when I go to the doctor whether that doctor is prescribing too much pain?
Well, I think the real issue is for physicians and patients are, how long do I need this medication? What's the minimal amount I need for the minimal amount of time? And then how do I use non-narcotics ways of dealing with it, which may include cognitive behavioral therapy, physical therapy, massage therapy to do it also. And I think it's just a different way of prospecting chronic pain. And if we do this in an intelligent way, we can keep the medications for those who need it and get rid of the abuse of those medications.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. And a listener joins in now, Zorba, from Wichita, Kansas. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how can we help?
Hi, I'm 32 weeks pregnant, and several weeks ago, my doctor told me that he was going to schedule me for the gestational diabetes screening. Mm-hmm. And I talked to several friends about it, and they had me hyped up for a terrible experience, like it was the worst test ever. But I talked to our doula about it, mm-hmm. and she suggested that, you know, I didn't necessarily have to take that test.
Let me go back a step for a second.
Okay.
So first of all, for those people who don't know what a doula is, mm-hmm. so it's not a common word, it's really
right.
Someone, how would you describe your doula?
As a labor coach.
Yes.
She'll be there
yes.
to help.
Right.
To help my husband and I through the labor process.
Yeah, very, very useful. Very useful as somebody who advocates for the patient, you know, in there. How much medicine do they really need? How much does she need to try to have a good delivery?
I'm glad you asked her that question because yeah. I thought, I'm the only person who doesn't know what this
no,
is.
No, it's not a common word. No. It's not a common thing at all, and it's become more common. So at 32 weeks, they want to do the diabetes test, which is you drink this sugary drink and have your blood drawn.
Right. I actually did it a couple of weeks ago.
Wow. Did you find it that bad?
No.
No, that's what I mean.
No,
I mean, you drink this.
Lots of women are very excited about it, and in a bad way. It's a miserable thing to do.
I mean, all you're doing is you're drinking this really sweet drink, which nobody likes to drink. It's not like the colonoscopy where you have to drink a gallon of it. Mm-hmm. You drink, yeah. You know, this cola that's incredibly sweet, and then you have a bunch of blood draws. You know, if you don't like having your blood drawn, well. That's an issue, but
right.
I wouldn't call it a test. So these friends of yours said the test was terrible.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, I've heard several people say, "Oh, you have to take that." So, like I said, it was no big deal for me, but it did have me thinking after talking to the doula. Like, are there some of these tests that they do that really not everybody needs to take?
Oh yes,
yeah.
Yeah. No, you are correct. I think the diabetes test is a useful test because gestational diabetes is common. It's not rare. Mm-hmm. It's important to know about it because it can affect the mom, the baby, and the labor. And so knowing whether or not you're diabetic, I think, is one of the keyly important things. The cultures that are done, you know, to find out whether or not you have strep, you know, a vaginal form of strep, a beta strep
right.
that's vaginal is important, whether or not you have chlamydia or another vaginal infection that you don't know about, that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
I think ultrasounds are often overused. I think there can be such a thing as too many ultrasounds. Why are you doing it? They add an expense to it, and they don't necessarily improve outcomes. They're just easy to do, and so we do more of them. I don't think they're harmful for the baby, but they may be harmful for the pregnancy because you see things that don't have any meaning, like, oh, well, we have to do another ultrasound in a week because we're worried about this and worried about that. So I think the judicious use of ultrasounds is good. The overuse is common.
Sure.
So you're right. The doula was correct. But that's why you have a doula, right?
Right. Well, and I've asked my doctor several times about the need for additional ultrasounds mm-hmm. when they've been ordered. I've asked if there's a reason why and if we're going to find something out that we can do something about or if it's just more information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think there are a lot of other things in medicine. I think there are definitely ultrasounds are one of those things that can be overordered, and then all of a sudden you get anxious, and things are fine. You know, so the real question is what's the right number, and then why do you go over that? And I think that's an important thing. I have a question for you. What does your obstetrician think about the doula?
Totally supportive.
Good.
I have a wonderful doctor.
That's the issue. Because you want
your... Yes, we've actually worked together before.
Excellent. Because you want your obstetrician on one hand, you want your doula on the other hand, you want to be in a birthing center where you have supportive nurses that are really supportive to make the delivery as wonderful as it can be, but you want to have all that technology there if things go south.
That's our plan.
Yeah, and that's what it is. When are you? How far along are you?
I'm 32 weeks now.
32 weeks. So well, you're in the final stretch.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
Thank you so much on your
delivery. I'm sure it's going to go well.
All right. Have a good day, guys.
You too.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. Okay, Zorba. Time again now for our medical MythBuster segment. Today's email is from a listener named Michael, who actually has firsthand experience about a potential myth we talked about on a past show. He writes, "Hi, Dr. Zorba and Tom. Let's talk about the recent MythBuster segment about peeing on a jellyfish sting to provide relief. I grew up north of Tripoli in Lebanon. Off the islands of Lebanon on certain days of the summer, you'd see tons of jellyfish, those white-looking lamps encroaching on the shoreside. Yes, you can immediately go and pee diddy on it. I have done that hundreds of times, and FYI, those stings are very painful. Definitely worth peeing on immediately."
So in other words, peeing on your jellyfish sting absolutely works. Okay, so we'll put that in the best of folk remedies part of the show. The best of folk remedies part of the show.
Have a possible myth for Zorba? you're in luck. He's happy to help. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413. The number, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. Now, before we head out today, Zorba, let's try something a little different. We get many emails and many phone calls at Zorba Pastor on Your Health, and we appreciate that very much. Sometimes we get a voicemail that's so much fun, we just have to share it. We're going to play a message we received from a very enthusiastic listener who really loves our show. He didn't leave his name, so we're going to call him Surfer Dude. Brad, let's hear it.
Yeah, I'm a goofy foot surfer from Huntington Beach, California, and you guys are awesome. It blows my mind, man. You guys are really on the trip, man. You guys got on the trip, man. I love your show. You guys are awesome. What can I say? Adios.
I love it.
Thanks for the call, Surfer Dude.
Thank you, Surfer Dude.
Do you think we're a beep trip? Or maybe you just have some good vibes for Zorba. Give us a call or send an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook, and that call might be played on the air.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Kawabunga Christensen, and our technical director is Bonza Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0528Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.